Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, and also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So Alabama was the epicenter of a big political event, earthquake you might call it, on December 12th. In a special election to fill the seat of Jeff Sessions, Alabama voters went to the polls and they picked a Democrat, Doug Jones, over the Republican, Roy Moore. In a deeply red state, this outcome was a big surprise. Though Moore was accused by multiple women of sexual assault and molestation and had a record of statements on issues like gay rights and race that were so extreme, they made the Tea Party seem moderate. It was close, and many suspected the GOP would pull through. President Trump threw his full support behind Moore in the final days. The RNC, which initially had pulled back from the Moore candidacy, also put their support back during the final days. But in the end, Doug Jones won. And the nation woke up to learn that Alabama now has a Democratic senator, which in recent years was not something we're familiar with. And Republicans were fretting about the possibility about losing both chambers of Congress in 2018. So it was a big night, Sam. And here we are to discuss this special election. So The first question, obviously, on everyone's mind is what exactly was the coalition that came together in Alabama that worked for Democrats? And it seems from what I'm reading, and you can correct me, that African-American turnout was essential to the victory, but so too was the vote of suburban white voters who seemed to have moved toward a Democrat, in part repulsed by Moore, but also maybe President Trump. And then the write-in seemed to have an effect. So that might be Republicans who are less than enthusiastic about where their party is right now. What are you seeing in the numbers?
Yeah, I think the big story here that I think has maybe been unappreciated or not talked about enough is the role of African-American voters. If you look in exit polls, over 90% of African Americans voted for Jones over Moore. 98% of African American women voted that way, and furthermore, turnout had a really strong correspondence with vote share. So in places where the Democrat did well. If Jones got 80% of the vote share out of the two-party vote share, then the turnout there was between 70 and 80% of what it was last November in the presidential election. In places where Jones's vote share was flipped the other way, where Moore got, say, 80% of the vote in Roy Moore territory, then the turnout was only 50 or 60% of what it was. And so there's a serious depression of turnout that's pretty clearly driven by, you know, like, look, the factors here, the big factor, I should back up and say, is lack of enthusiasm for President Trump. Trump's low approval ratings were surely a major driver of this. And then on top of this, of course, the fact that that the candidate himself is also a sexual predator. And so, you know, a sexual predator endorsed by someone else who is thought to be a probable sexual predator, it's just too much. And so if you look at it, yeah, my take on it is that it's a huge enthusiasm for their votes making a difference among the African-American community in Alabama. And also just this differential turnout where, look, if your party is just, I mean, if you look in the exits, Trump's approval rating is tied at 48-48, which is in a state that went in the last three elections involving non-sexual predators. In Alabama, we're talking about the governor's election in 2014 and the presidential election of 2012. The median margin in Alabama is 22 points for the Republican candidate over the Democratic candidate. And so to swing from R plus 22% to what we saw last night, 2% for the Democrat, you know, it's a 24-point swing. And I say broadly, I would say that comes out to something like about 13 or 14 points of that existed before the bombshell in the Washington Post. And so therefore, probably because of Roy Moore being kind of a not such great candidate, plus Doug Jones being a good candidate, plus Trump disapproval, maybe another 5 points, 5 to 7 points because of the sexual predation bombshell. And then another, you know, say another 5 points because of turnout.
So it seems like I'm listening to you, and there seems to be two issues that are certainly relevant for how this plays out maybe in the midterms. One would be the third part of what you just talked about, meaning how much is the disapproval of President Trump, assuming it remains at the same level that we saw depressing turnout in a Republican state like Alabama, and obviously in less red states, that would be pretty problematic. And the other part that's interesting is everyone kept talking about what Democrat or which Democratic candidates can put together the Obama coalition that Hillary Clinton was unable to do. And at least seems from Alabama that negativity might be able to do that, meaning the opposition to Trump might be pretty powerful as well in making up for what the absence of Obama or an Obama-like candidate might do. I mean, those would be the two big factors for Democrats who are trying to figure out what to make of this beyond the immediate race. But, I mean, the more you remove Roy Moore, the more, I guess, we can learn about the implications here.
Well, let's put bounds on it. I was doing some calculations on this, and let's just put some limits on this. So if we think back to last November in the presidential election, Donald Trump was had the worst favorability of any candidate in the last 40 years. And then I think Hillary Clinton is third worst, and Barry Goldwater is kind of in between him. So it's kind of down there. And so Trump had a lot of extreme qualities to him that really reflected the worst parts of the Republican base, personal conduct, the way he related to conventional politics. And so there's something about him that was extreme. But on the national scene, there was this symmetry of polarization where the Republican voters in the United States believe a lot of things about Hillary Clinton. Media coverage really focused on not on policies, but on things like, emails and stuff like that. And so in the public eye, the national race last year was very much this this symmetric situation in which a lot of things were said about both candidates, and it became about a race to the bottom as opposed to, a race about issues or what have you. To the extent that it was about issues, it was about Donald Trump's issues. And so if you look at the national level, the net of all that was that Trump lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by 2 points, but House down-ticket candidates won the national vote by about 1 percentage point. So actually, the net of all that was that Trump underperformed what I would call a generic Republican preference, where generically people seem to prefer Republican candidates down-ticket. And the net of all that was only about a 3-point difference. Now that sentiment is pretty different today because currently Trump's approval ratings are quite low. So that time I would say that, I would estimate something like, it seems like people who would otherwise vote Republican back last November, about 94% of them stuck with Trump and ended up voting for him, which is a lot, right? Like that's real partisan loyalty. Now, right. Now compare that with Trump's current approval rating. His approval rating is in the high 30s, and that means that right now about 80% of Republican voters currently support him. I'm not saying people who say they're Republican. I'm just saying 38% of people support him. 48% of people voted for him. So 38 divided by 48, that's about 80%. And so that kind of corresponds a little bit to what's happening here. Now, in the Roy Moore case, Moore is a divisive candidate. He was removed from office as a judge. He's quite clearly not like even other Southern Republicans, right? He prances around on stage with a gun. He thinks that being Muslim should be illegal. His wife was making a speech a couple of days before the election saying, one of our attorneys is a Jew, so we're not anti-Semitic. And just like, whoa, right. Geez, guy, And so so there is this you take all of that. And I would say that even after all that, I think that if you look at the numbers, still about 82% of Moore still got more than 4/5 of the votes that some other more garden variety Republican would get. So there's a few things, just to unpack this a little bit, there's a few things going on here. Doug Jones did not have any negatives other than the generic negatives that are associated with being a Democrat, right? He was a high quality candidate, a person of obviously high character as far as anybody could tell. And, you know, he had baggage like being pro-choice, but that's standard baggage for a Democrat. And so there was asymmetric baggage. And so that's different from the Trump versus Clinton race. And the other thing is that just the intensity of the baggage that Moore had. So I think at some level, I guess what I'm saying is that you take all this and put it together, and we've discovered the floor. The floor for Republicans is apparently that about 4/5 of their side will vote for anything.
Anyone.
Where, you know, I mean, yeah. Really, someone who's accused of sexually assaulting an eighth grader, you know, I'd call that pretty close to anything. It's like Nancy Pelosi said about Donald Trump. Evidently, to some voters, any mammal will do. And and this is a little bit like that. So I think that we discovered the floor for people compared with a garden variety Republican. This is the floor when you have a really bad candidate.
Yeah, I guess the question is, if you had a better candidate than Moore, if you had even
Luther Strange,
if that would have either bumped up that Republican support or, you know, mitigated some of the Democratic enthusiasm.
Well, let's be cold blooded about it. Let's just do the numbers and not really think about any of the substantive details. So broadly speaking, Trump is some kind of drag on down ticket races and all these special elections. If you look in the last 11 months, Democratic candidates have performed about a median of about 11 points better. This is something like 40 different special elections in the last 11 months. They've performed about 11 points better than the Trump versus Clinton race last November. And so the baseline is that any Republicans is starting with a minus 11 point margin. Now in Alabama, that only gets you that takes a Republican candidate from winning by 22 points to only winning by 11 points. And so the baseline is the lead for a Republican gets cut to 11 points. And so broadly speaking, Luther Strange doesn't seem to stick out from other Republicans. And so I think it's almost certain that he would have, had he been able to get through the primaries, he would have been able to win that election.
Yeah, I guess the question is, I mean, the difference with 2016, obviously, is Trump just looms much larger now in the minds of American voters. And it will be easier for Democrats they'll have a variety of candidates all over the country. So yeah. Some will be as good as Jones, others won't be. But no one will be as big in the mind of a voter as Trump. And so
right.
You know, Democrats can just focus on Trumpifying every Republican.
Yeah. So Trump was in the fall of 2016, the weirdness of Trump was a hypothetical,
right,
in the sense that he wasn't actually president yet. And now we've all gotten a big fat dose of 11 months of what an actual Trump presidency is like. And so, you know, there's just no denying that it's a pretty unusual experience. And now I think it's become pretty clear what happens. So at some level, this was, you know, irrespective of Trump running towards Moore, away from Moore, you know, all the stuff that he did, this is very much a microcosm of this division. I think at this point, everybody knows this, a division within the Republican Party in which there's a faction that wants this kind of thing, that's okay with this kind of thing. And nationally, it was about 40% of Republican primary voters. It was enough to get Trump over the top. In Alabama, it was enough to get Roy Moore to the nomination. And this is a faction that that gave the nation Trump.
Right.
And gave Alabama Roy Moore, and in the second case, it was a bridge too far for about, you know, ballpark about 10% of Alabama voters.
I mean, and that's the other concern for the Republicans. That group of voters, that faction, which is sizable, is around. It's not as if after Roy Moore loses, they all go away or they all say, okay, someone else can pick our candidates. There's going to be a lot of races where they're still. You know, it might not be Roy Moore or Donald Trump, but it could be that variety of Republicans certainly gonna pop up in some of these races.
Right. So ballpark, I guess, I tend to say things that are too dense with numbers. Ballpark, the Trump effect of having
that's
this wing. What's that?
That's your specialty.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, like I would say ballpark, the effect of this division within the Republican Party appears, I think we now, it's starting to come into focus, that it that when it's given its full voice, can cost the Republicans about 3 to 5 percentage points. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it now, even though Trump won the presidential election, we saw it then. We're seeing it now with Roy Moore. And so we can see how bad it can be for Republicans. And in a polarized environment where the national environment is very closely fought, being shorted 3 to 5% whenever a Trumpy kind of candidate comes up is a pretty substantial penalty. And that's, you know, that could be enough to, you know, if that wing of the party gets its way in any of the Republican primaries coming up in the next year's midterm elections, that's a real serious handicap.
And we'll move on in a second, but the other, when we talk about polarization, the assumption is always that the voter of one party will want the candidate of that party to win. But I guess the other kind of partisan loyalty that might unfold in this kind of chaotic environment is, you know, just the lack, let's get through this era. Even if that means not voting or writing in people so that the party can restore itself, that's still partisanship. And I assume a little bit of that was at work with some Alabama voters.
Well, let's see. So if you it looks like turnout was pretty lousy for those Republican voters. And if you look in Doug Moore, if you look in Roy Moore country, you know, turnout was pretty well depressed. And so these are people who, you know, for whatever reason, if you look at exits, for instance, 91% of people who say they're Republicans say they voted for Roy Moore. So if they could get themselves to the polls, it looks like most of them voted for Moore. But the key question here is getting to the polls in the first place. Midterm elections and special elections are traditionally, in recent memory, times that are good for Republicans. Republican voters are whiter, and whites vote better than other ethnic groups in the United States. But here the tables were turned. Here African Americans were just out in droves. And I agree with you back to your a few points ago. I agree with you that that white suburban voters were an issue here just as they were in the presidential election. But I think the big story here is that African Americans in Alabama were a powerhouse that got the Democratic candidate over the top. And I think that is an interesting point because there's this tendency to, you know, like our colleague Kevin Cruz was saying on Twitter this morning that maybe instead of liberal billionaires buying full page ads to encourage Republicans to impeach Trump, how about paying for some get out the vote operations for African Americans? Wouldn't that be a little bit better use of money, you know, from a liberal standpoint?
No, that's a good point. And so, okay, so one thing we see in Alabama, and most rational Republicans are going to be upset about what happened. They're going to be concerned about the implications. And it shows that there is some kind of Trump effect going on here, and they can pay the cost. And so I'm sure there's a lot of head scratching and concern right now in Republican circles. This is a very, we keep talking about what does Trump do to the party. This is going to be a measure for a lot of Republicans about what can happen. Then it's the Democrats. And so that's a good place to start in terms of how important the get out the vote would be and was in this particular race. But then there is Doug Jones and thinking about what does this mean for Democrats? And I don't – Charles Barkley, who's become the political pundit of the moment – he was on TV in some interview saying that, you know, he's been very vocal in this campaign. I don't know if you've heard him at all, Sam.
I haven't heard him directly, but
actually really interesting. I mean, the first thing he said a few weeks ago, he came out. He's from Alabama, obviously. That's where he started his basketball career. And he made a pretty pointed statement about how he didn't understand how someone like Moore could even be on the ballot and how someone with the support of a white nationalist like Steve Bannon, these are his words, could be running and what that said about the state. But last night he thought the election was a wake-up call for Democrats as well, that they shouldn't take for granted the vote of African Americans, the vote of Americans living in poor economic circumstances. That's what the Democrats had done. And that's not what Doug Jones did. And so I guess this opens up the question of what do Democrats take away from this? So one is concrete. It's you need to mobilize and you need to get people to the polls. But the other question is, what does Doug Jones tell us about the kind of candidates Democrats should be running? What do you think?
Well, in an age of polarization, the big challenge to either party is to get out their vote, to increase turnout, to get their party faithful to come out. And pundits like to talk about things like winning over suburban whites or winning over, you know, the Bernie Sanders voters and so on. Like, there's this set of voters, typically white, who are trying to be won over. And I think that that is one approach. But I think that one thing that the Republicans have really excelled at, they're very, you know, as a party, they're very good campaigners, and they're very good at mobilizing people within their coalition, as it were. And so here what Barkley is saying is that here's a powerful traditional Democratic constituency, African Americans, and when suitably motivated, that is a community that will come out and vote. And so now when it becomes a turnout election, the issue of turnout has always been thought of as being something that leads to a Republican advantage. But in a national environment where the Republican Party, where Trump is the face of the Republican Party, and where Trump's brand is toxic, at this point, places that were once out of reach become within reach. And in an off-year election, turnout becomes key. And if African Americans can be motivated by candidates who are high-quality candidates who speak to their priorities, they will go out and vote. This high turn. I mean, if you look at the get out the vote operations in Alabama, hundreds of thousands of doors were knocked on in the days leading up to the election. It's something like I'm looking here. There's this there's a group, the Black Progressive Action Coalition, and what they said was they knocked on 257,000 doors. 257,000 doors as part of a nonpartisan program in Jefferson, Madison, Mobile, Montgomery, in Tuscaloosa. And so that was a massive get out the vote operation. And it's fascinating to see that happen in an off year. And that just goes to show that I think that's what happens when you have a president who is who's polarizing. By the way, I have to say something, which is Charles Barkley is a pundit now. So I just want to just imagine going back in time and saying, yes, Charles Barkley has a lot to say about get out the vote operations. And in this world, President Donald Trump is unpopular and under investigation. Like, what would people say if they could see our world?
Well, I think that's part of the reaction from last night. So obviously, there's many Democrats who are giddy. Like, this shows we can win again, and there's a possibility for a path forward. But I think there's probably a little bit of, and it's only one race, but a little bit of relief after all the craziness we have now seen in our political world, that sometimes the more predictable, expected, or rational outcome can happen. Yeah. I think there were a lot of people going in last night who were like, well, the senator's accused, or the candidate accused of child molestation and says, you know, Islam should be illegal and praises the era of slavery was about to win. But back to the Democrat. The other thing about Jones, it's interesting. You do have this debate, and I understand it's pundit driven, but what the Democrats should do, should they have centrists? Should they have more Bernie Sanders types? And he's kind of interesting. I mean, he was interesting in that he didn't have any negatives, as you're saying, no personal scandals or no controversial statements, but he was a real interesting mix of he is a Southern white guy, pretty moderate on a lot of issues, but on some of the issues that are usually put into the identity category, such as abortion rights, and also impeccable credentials on civil rights, given his own work on the issue, I think that was really important. And for me, that's a little bit of important reminder to Democrats not to put those issues aside.
Yeah. Well, I think Democrats, I think if you look at survey data, Democrats report wanting candidates who will deliver on them on issues that are their priorities. And so for them, they weigh issue stance, whether it be on abortion or guns or on social spending or civil liberties. These matter a lot to Democrats. But if you look at survey data among Republican voters put a lot of value on people who stick with their principles and take a stand. And they there is admiration you can see in survey data that Republican voters really admire somebody who will take an unpopular stand because it's who they are. It's who their principles are. And so, okay, Jones is pro-choice, and that is not a popular stance in Alabama. But, you know, in Alabama, that's a very Republican state. And it is likely that this is a state where people admire a candidate who just says, here I am. This is who I am. I fought to prosecute those killers. I am also pro-choice. It's just the man that I am. And so I think that that there is this hand-wringing among Democratic strategists to worry about issue stands. But probably the better thing would be probably to worry about just putting up high-quality candidates of character, because it's becoming clear that the next year, you know, everything is aligning to make character up front as an issue, whether it be getting rid of John Conyers or Al Franken leaving office. I mean, you know, like one could argue about whether that was actually warranted on substantive grounds, but it is very much lining up that that character is being set up. And at some level, you know, I think it's a relief probably for Republicans not to have Roy Moore as a dead weight next year, because imagine having him around.
So there's two other issues, I think, that are people are wondering what role they played. One is the hashtag Me Too and just the attention to issues of sexual harassment and gender related issues that have been in the news for the last 2 months front and center, and how much that played a role in making Moore even more vulnerable for the kinds of allegations he faced and the way he dismissed them. And the second is the media. I mean, he was the subject of some hard-hitting journalism that counteracted the Fox News accounts of who he was. And the Washington Post stories and all the follow-ups about his background, as well as the reminders of the kinds of statements he made, I assume both of those two factors had an effect yesterday.
Well, the race was already within 5 percentage points before that. So I think that surveys suggested that the race was closer than you would expect for a generic Republican against a generic Democrat, even before that, those bombshells hit. So I would suggest that that the race was already closed, maybe because of Roy Moore's history in Alabama. And as I said, Donald Trump's unpopularity, both in Alabama relative to where he ought to be. So ballpark, Democrats needed to close the gap by 22 points. And they closed it up about halfway because of Trump's unpopularity and maybe Moore's quirks. And the other half of the way was because of the Washington Post bombshell, because of all the things that came to light about Roy Moore's personal conduct. So I think that I'd say if someone wanted to translate what happened yesterday into a national mood, yeah, I think about half of that is something that is present nationally. And so, you know, an 11-point swing in a closely divided country, that's about half of what we just saw. An 11-point swing is a pretty large swing. That's what we've seen, as I was saying earlier, it's what we've seen in all these other special elections. And if legislative elections and congressional elections swing by 11 points next November, that is a really big swing. By modern standards, that's a really large move.
All right, let's turn to that. So we've covered what happened in Alabama, what it means for Alabama, and there's the practical impact on the Senate. Republicans, at least after this tax bill passes, it seems like.
Yeah.
It looks like the Republicans are going to try to beat Jones being seated, but they'll have one less person, and it's already been difficult enough to govern the Senate with a 52-person majority. So it will have a very concrete impact on the Republicans trying to do anything legislatively, especially with the president, you know, just losing more and more control of himself, it seems, day by day. And then the second is what you just said. What's this all portend for the midterm elections? And it's hard not to see this as a sign that the Senate really is competitive now. It's possible to imagine come January 2019, we're looking at a Democratic Congress.
Easy to imagine. At this point, I think on a conservative site, Decision Desk, I think the proprietor of that was saying that if he were a betting man, he'd be buying shares of Democratic control of the Senate, like in large quantities right now, because that's a stock that's headed up. So, you know, an 11-point swing is very clearly enough to put the House into Democratic hands. Will it happen? Don't know. But current conditions over the last 11 months are definitely in the range of a bloodbath for Republicans in the House. And now, you know, coming up with three seats, going from 52-48 to 51-49 the other way, would have involved a net of three seats, which is a pretty tough lift. You know, one can imagine it, but it was a tough lift. But going from 51-49, look, to pass any kind of legislation, losing two Republicans now is the end of the line for anything that's purely partisan. And so, you know, either they're not going to get anything between now and next November, or they have to adopt legislative strategies of the past, which I might remind everyone, legislative strategies of the past in a closely divided chamber involved bipartisanship and involved getting both parties involved. As we see in Germany, right? Angela Merkel is building a coalition of multiple parties. And so, you know, that normal, what I would have called a normal mode of governing would be the only way through. Now, it's not at all clear that's going to happen, but I'm just pointing out that that's a given the behavior of Mitch McConnell and the strategic choices that have been made so far, that's super hard. And yeah, like just picking off a couple of seats. I mean, gosh, you know, Arizona, Jeff Flake's seat, and I don't know, knocking off maybe Ted Cruz, which is, you know, a bit of a reach, but not crazy. Or in Tennessee, there's an open seat there, and a high enough quality candidate on the Democratic side, right, could, you know, make it competitive. I mean, it's no longer crazy to imagine Democrats retaking the Senate.
It's hard to imagine the Democrats cooperating with Republicans right now. I mean, there's almost no incentive for them to do anything. If they're willing to withstand the reputation for a year of being obstructionists, which Republicans never mind, but Democrats always get uneasy with.
So to get away from the strategy,
from a governance, that this is looking terrible for, and you know, the bet is that President Trump will not get better governing.
Well, what about just a kind of a nerdy point about policy? What about, I don't know, protecting the Affordable Care Act, renewing the CHIP legislation for children's health, DACA for deferred action on immigrants? Like, what about those policy goals? Because, you know, Democrats are policy nerds. Like,
no, I know that. I know that. And so the Democratic instinct on all the three things you just said will always be, well, we have to fix the policy. Whereas I think Republicans have a tougher instinct that we're going to focus on the politics. And I don't know how Senator Schumer, I mean, they must be tasting victory right now, really kind of seeing what the map could look like. And I don't know. It'll be a competition. Certainly, they're not going to do anything grand, though. But there'll be some Democrats worried they do too much of that. It will make the Republican majority and the president look as if they're effective.
It's hard to imagine doing enough to undo the massive unpopularity of Donald Trump. My take on that is that, I don't know, from a
you can fix a few things and wait for the next tweet to erase any.
Yeah, exactly. I think that no matter how many policy things get fixed, look, there's like this giant dumpster fire occupying the White House. Like, why not just, I mean, from an electoral standpoint, like the guy's got low approvals. Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm giving voice to the policy nerd who sees all these opportunities for things that could easily get 60 votes in the Senate.
Do you think that the Democrats could keep this seat in Alabama, or is it, you know, when it, I guess it expires in 2021, will it revert back to a Republican? I know that's far out. I mean,
it's pretty far out, but I have to admit, the whole thing looks like it's going to be a few years for Doug Jones, and in a state that's 22 points Republican preferring, it is pretty hard to imagine. Yeah, possibly, but you know, it depends on what he does in the next 3 years as senator.
And obviously, if Donald Trump is running for re-election in 2020, that'll be a big part of the landscape.
Right, then it's a person of, you know, presumably a person of high character, Doug Jones, in an environment that's pretty tough for Republicans. You can imagine him having a fighting chance, but you know, it is a pretty heavily Republican state.
You got to imagine the White House is worried at whatever they say in public. I mean, they must be worried a little bit about the Republicans starting to get angry with them more publicly. But more important, they must be thinking about this midterm with all these investigations. I mean, a rational person, at least, would be frightened by what happened.
Well, people have been talking pretty brave. You remember a few months ago we had Leonard Lance on. Yeah. Moderate Republican, moderate conservative is how he describes himself. And he won by, I forget, 10, 15 points, something like that in the last election. And I asked him if he was concerned and he didn't express any concern. But surely, yeah, as you're saying, he must feel the cold finger on his spine at this point.
One other thing that someone told me, and I'm curious of your thought, that they were what will the impact, assuming the tax bill goes through and this elimination of the deduction for state and local taxes is in it, they were talking about the potential effects on House races. And so that there would be enough damage to districts in states like California, New York, and New Jersey, where Republicans currently hold the seat, that could also be a factor in flipping the House, just the anger as the tax bill starts to hit. And it looks like it's going to hit as soon as next year, if the timing that we're seeing goes through. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, of course. I mean, look, if close districts, like especially in California, where there are some competitive races, I mean, like Daryl Issa or what have you, or in here in New Jersey, like I said, Lance and Frelinghuysen, no matter which way they vote, they can say that they voted, they can say that they voted against this legislation, but look, their party voted for it. And it just seems like such an obvious point to hit them on, which is that, look, we were voting for a Republican and that meant voting for lower taxes. And you just voted for an increase on your own constituents' taxes. Like, just feels like an obvious message that cuts right to the heart of who they're supposed to be as, as politicians.
You know, I'm always whenever I'm asked about special elections, I'm usually the guy saying, don't read too much into them. And, that doesn't necessarily tell you what's going to happen. But I'll tell you, this one feels a little different. And I think there's a practical difference in that the loss of a seat has an immediate effect. But it does seem, from talking about it with you, from looking at what happened, just from understanding the role of the Trump presidency in this, which is where we started the conversation, this could really be a pretty serious sign of what's to come in 2018.
Well, if you go to election.princeton.edu and the Princeton Election Consortium and scroll down the side, I linked to Daily Coast Elections' list of special elections. And I certainly agree that one should always be careful about interpreting any one special election, but their spreadsheet, the Daily Coast Elections people do a great job of gathering data. Their spreadsheet contains 67 special elections. And those 67 special elections, I mean, at some point, sure, the individual data points are highly variable. But when 67 of them point toward a 10 or 11 point swing away from the president's party, at some point, at some point that data's got to be worth something.
Hey, one last thing.
Yeah.
How are the polls on this election? How did they perform?
Not so great. I would say not so great with a caveat where they were self-aware. So there was self-awareness on the part of Monmouth and other organizations that there was a problem. So the median result, the results were all over the place. Fox News had the Democrat up by 10 points. There were other survey organizations like Gravis that showed the Republican up by 6 points. A pretty wide range of outcomes. The median showed that Moore was going to be was favored by 4 to 6 points. So it looked like Moore was ahead. But at the same time, there were survey organizations that pointed out that it was really heavily dependent on the turnout model. And Monmouth in particular had some calculations. Also, I believe I forget who the other organization is. I think YouGov maybe had hypothetical calculations showing that depending on the turnout model, there was a wide range of possible outcomes. So I think that polling organizations recognized that it was a tough situation. And so I think it was a hard polling environment. But, as a group, they were pretty far off. And what I think that suggests is that in these special elections, one should be very careful about interpreting such polls at face value. Now, on the other hand, an organization that did super well was The Upshot at the New York Times. If people were watching that, they had a model in which they took county-by-county returns and compared them with expectations and used that to extrapolate, well, are Moore and Jones doing better or worse than expected compared with what we were what we thought walking in. And their model converged on a narrow Jones victory as early as 9 p.m. last night. And so their model actually did a quite good job of capturing live, real data coming in over the transom and converting that to an estimator. And I actually liked that estimator a lot. It was you know, a lot of the same guts of algorithms and so on that they used on election night for the presidency. And so it was the same needle and the same stuff. So the same stuff under the hood as far as, you know, at least for, from a user standpoint. That was a very interesting tool that I think that people will be, I hope, making use of in the future. I think the people at The Upshot really are doing a good job of committing real live data journalism on election night in a way that, you know, frankly, television programs, you know, cable nets have not been quite so good at. Even though cable networks surely have the data available to them, they haven't really translated into something that people can use in the way that the Times has done.
All right, Sam, we're out of time. So that wraps up our episode. And let's thank everyone for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.